Good morning. Open the Committee on Finance and Revenue. Senator George, thank you for helping guide this committee the past couple days.
It's a good thing you got back here, though. We were about to move some of those bills.
Oh, boy. Actually, then I'll leave, and you can move some of these bills, and I'll get out of the middle of them.
Senator George was very disciplined. He kept saying, now the chair doesn't want to move this one yet.
Well, I appreciate that. Again, I could just leave and let you move the rest of the bills for the session, and then I don't have to be right in the middle. Okay, so let's do Senate Bill 179 first, since I think we have a lot of folks who've traveled to be with us here today on 179, and we'll get the issues out before us and make a decision of whether we want to wait for a dash 3 or move the bill and work on it in the meantime. Open a work session on Senate Bill 179. Chris.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you have before you a draft revenue impact statement. It's a reference bill number, Senate Bill 179-2. It would actually apply to both the dash 1 and the dash 2. It's basically the revenue impact of moving to a single sales factor. One of the issues that was actually the impetus for the bill was the interpretation of current law. And the debate there was, under current law, it's a three-factor formula. And the issue there is whether or not, in determining the apportionment percentage, the divisor is always three, or if it's adjusted according to the number of existing factors. Upon conferring with Ledge Council, the interpretation, the opinion that I got there, was that the current law would be adjusting for the missing factors. So in a case where an insurance company only had two factors, their apportionment percentage would be divided by two, not three. And so that sets the current law basis for the revenue impact that you have before you. So the revenue impact is the difference between that law and moving to the single sales factor. So I was just going to walk through a few of the steps and explain the revenue impact, because there are some nuances to it. Whether or not moving to a single sales factor would increase or decrease a taxpayer's taxes depends on many of the circumstances related specifically to that taxpayer. One of those factors is whether or not they are domiciled in Oregon, a domestic insurer, or domiciled in another state, a foreign insurer. And basically, the domestic insurers, their individuals' taxpayers can either have an increase or decrease in taxes. It depends on what their sales factor is versus what the average factor of their existing factors is.
And by domestic, you mean?
Headquartered in Oregon.
In Oregon.
And the difference between, or how it plays into here, the domestic insurers are not subject to Oregon's retaliatory tax, but foreign insurers are. So I've broken them out into those two groups. And in the table there, on the whole, the domestic insurers are expected to have lower tax liability by moving to a single sales factor. And in aggregate, I expect that to be a tax reduction of about $2 million a year. So we have an estimate of 4.3 for the 07-09 biennium. Now, for the foreign insurers, the impact is a little more complicated, and this is why we went back last time and working with the Department of Revenue in the Assurance Division to calculate these taxes. So we went back for 3 years, 2002 through 2004, the Department of Revenue provided the Insurance Division with estimates of the excise tax, and then the Insurance Division was able to calculate the retaliatory tax for each insurance company individually. It has to be done on an individual basis. And that was based from what I described earlier as the interpretation of current law to get to the revenue impact. So we'd have the current law set of numbers and then the single sales factor set of numbers. And again, here, with the foreign insurers, you'll have some taxpayers who have an increase in taxes under the single sales and some that have a decrease. In aggregate, though, we can see that the excise tax would go up by about $9 million a year for the foreign insurers, and the retaliatory tax would only decrease by about $6.5 million. And that's due to the offsetting nature of those taxes. During the last work session, it was assumed that the retaliatory tax would offset about 90% of the excise tax. And what we found here is that offset is only about 70%. So combining these pieces together results in a slightly positive revenue impact. Now, in any given year, the revenue impact in aggregate may be positive or negative. In the 3 years, 2002 through 2004, 2 years resulted in a positive impact and one in a negative impact. Hmm. And some of the factors that play into that are the distribution of the liability among the affected companies. There are around 1,100 insurance companies that pay both the excise tax and the insurance tax, and 80% of them are actually unaffected by the change in policy, either because they don't have positive taxable income or the retaliatory tax completely offsets the excise tax. We have an offsetting factors there. So the revenue impact here is mainly due to 20% of the companies. So we're talking in the neighborhood of 200 companies that are driving the revenue impact, and in ballpark figures, 50 of them result in a tax increase and 150 of them result in a tax decrease. And then peeling away some of those layers, there is still, even within that level of concentration, there are a handful of insurers that kind of dominate the field, if you will, that have a significantly large, represent a significantly large share of that taxpayer. So in each year, 2002 through 2004, there were a couple of outliers where this one taxpayer had, due to this policy change, would have experienced, say, a large tax increase or large tax decrease. So removing those from the field, from the analysis and seeing what played out, still get a slightly positive revenue impact on average. Again, in any given year, it could be negative. Mm-hmm. But kind of a long-term average impact is slightly positive, which is what you see before you in that table under just the net aggregate line, the general fund. And that's, ballpark speaking, a revenue gain to the state of about $700,000 a year or $1.5 million per biennium.
Questions for Chris?
Well, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Monroe.
What we're really talking about is whether to go to a single factor, right?
Correct.
In my study and teaching of tax law, there are certain things that we look for. One is relative simplicity, understandability, complex. The more complex a tax law is, probably the more difficult it is for people to understand and to accept. So simplicity is something that's important. Fairness is the other thing. Perceived fairness, that it treats everybody, you know, level playing field. And I'm looking at this and trying to determine whether or not going to a single factor increases the simplicity and does not make it less fair than the current system.
Okay, so let's hear from Standard. Do you guys want to testify? Maybe we'll bring up Oregon Mutual with Standard. I would think they have similar perspectives. Steve Patterson, no longer with the Blazers.
Yeah.
Won the lottery.
Boy, talk about bad timing.
That's it, yeah. Literally won the lottery.
I think that even I couldn't escape this one.
So we'll go with Mr. Patterson first and then to Standard.
Mr. Chairman, member Steve Patterson with Oregon Mutual Insurance Company in McMinnville, Oregon. We're here in part to support single sales factor. I think we all held our breath. I remember our last meeting, Senator Monroe kind of put the challenge out. He wanted to make sure this wasn't going to cost the general revenue. We now see that at worst it's sort of a push, could go either way, but that it may increase. And on the two issues that Senator Monroe just laid out, I think it is simpler. We're talking about one factor. The cases that have been in the courts have all been over which of the three factors didn't exist or should be thrown out, or is it fair to the company? Your sales to Oregonians in this state as a measure of your presence and your taxability in the state seems very clear, very, very simple. The fairness is what we came and testified in the very first hearing, and that is by going to a single sales factor, we removed two other factors out of the equation, one of them being the wages and commissions that we pay in Oregon, which for a domestic company like ours punishes us for being in Oregon. And so it doesn't punish anybody else to go to a single sales factor and not have those. Those tend to take their taxes down. but for the people that are actually paying living wage jobs in Oregon to Oregonians, and two of those insurers are represented here, this is more fair for purposes of the cost factors that go into our products as compared to our competitors. We're now talking about the same measure of tax. And so I think it meets those two factors. We've been in discussions with the Department of Revenue this morning on a couple things that would clean up and make this bill meet their objective, meet our objective, being a single sales factor. And I think we'd like to work that out and come back to you with the bill that we'd all be happy and proud to see you pass.
Great. And any feelings about non-domestic, or I guess in this thing we call them foreign insurers, and that whole, just the issue of the retaliatory tax?
On the retaliatory tax, that sort of equalizes itself over the different jurisdictions that they operate in. An Oregon company doing business in their jurisdiction would be equally affected. So as far as the fairness of it, whether they increase or decrease, again, we're going back to a known quantity. What is the percentage of your business that you sell to Oregonians compared to everything else you do? It seems to be the simplest and fairest for them as well. And in fact, a lot of our industry brethren that are foreign companies have told us that they do not oppose this measure. And I'm sure there may be some, but they certainly couldn't say that it wasn't because this was unfair.
Great. Standard Insurance.
Chair Deckert, members of the committee, my name is Justin Delaney. I'm the Assistant General Counsel at Standard. And with me today is Nancy Gwynn, the head of our tax department. If you have any technical questions, I would encourage you to ask her. I believe that the question on the table was whether this would ease taxes and whether it's fair. And I think both can answer very easily. Yes, it's easier. One factor is easier to calculate on both sides, for us and for the state. Is it fair? This is what other states have already started to move to. They've recognized that the three-pronged system penalizes their domestic companies for having employees in the state. And from a policy perspective, I think that answers the question. It's a trend. It's one that would remove a penalty on Standard and Oregon Mutual and a handful of others for investing in Oregon.
Great.
Chair Deckert, members of the committee, I would I think Justin was pretty succinct in his comments. The only thing that I would add in terms of fairness is we use a single factor apportionment for all other industries within this state, and I think it is a fair way to tax insurance companies as well. I did bring something so you can see how easy this is to administer. This would be the basis of a single sales factor. It's just out of the blue book, easy. There's no games, there's no add backs, it's all right here. Very simple for me as a taxpayer to prepare the Oregon excise tax return. Very easy for the Department of Revenue to come in and audit.
And what are you?
Oh, this is, Chair Deckert, this is our annual statement. This is if you're an insurance.
Standards.
Yeah, this is standards. If you're an insurance company, this is the basis of our tax return, Oregon excise tax return, and this would be the basis of our apportionment factor if we change to a single sales factor. Easy.
Great. Questions for Oregon Mutual? Yes, Senator Monroe.
So it would be your testimony that this would reduce your cost of tax preparation?
Absolutely.
And I'm assuming it would also reduce the cost to the department of reviewing your tax preparation.
Absolutely.
That's a good thing.
Senator George.
And that was to tag on to what was just said, is that disputes and litigation would appear to me, when you have a simple program, and this has been addressed a little bit already, would be significantly decreased.
Absolutely.
That means heads are nodding.
Yes.
Chair Deckard, I wanted to add also, you asked about out-of-state companies. You know that Standard shares a lobbyist with a number of out-of-state insurers. I can't speak on his behalf. He's in another hearing today, but I certainly would have heard from those companies had they objected, and we have not.
Yeah, I have not either, which yeah. I've noted that I have not heard a great deal of.
Pretty glaring silence.
Yeah, it's been surprising to me. And what are the issues around the Dash 3 that it sounds like Oregon Mutual and Standard would like to hold off today if possible and work out these remaining issues that would be incorporated into a Dash 3?
Chair Deckard, Steve Patterson again. I've been in front of legislative committees for a lot of years, and this is going so well, I even hesitate to say.
It is going well. I will
hold up on anything. There were a couple issues that we were working on with the Department of Revenue and that we discovered in talking to Standard that are different in the way life insurance companies report on their annual statement and the way property and casualty companies report. Mm-hmm. Current law has the word received, premiums received, and the Dash 2, I think, has premiums earned. We report earned in P&C. They report received. So we want to find a way to make sure those two things harmonize so that you can use what is on your annual report as filed with the regulator. There were some issues with regard to the retroactivity of the apportionment factor. Sort of got into how the law is being interpreted. And we want to make sure that everybody's on the same page with how that would work.
So interpreted in terms of tax year 2006 or 2005?
Right. Going backwards, not forwards. That'd be pretty easy. One factor. So were those the two main factors? And so there were a couple that we thought would be significant if we missed them that we'd like to make sure that everybody agrees on so we can bring you a bill that is not in dispute with either the Department of Insurance or the companies that is dealing with on this issue.
Correct.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Monroe.
And I would just urge you to hurry.
Yes, sir.
Because we're wrapping up around here. 30 days from now, we may be signy dying. So and this is a Senate bill, which means you still have to talk to those 60 folks over on the other end of the building. Okay.
Other questions? Senator George.
Is there agreement for the Dash 3s? I mean, okay, department.
I think the Department of Revenue is here, and we have philosophically agreed on all the changes that we would make.
Right. I'll try to put the – yes, Senator George.
Just a quick follow-up. The urgency that Senator Monroe pointed out, we've heard rumors they may actually try to shut down the House on the 11th of this next month. So you guys, if you would talk that over, I mean, the main thing is that at least get it in their hands.
Right.
Do the amendments later. It'd be nice to have a really good, clean bill go out of here, though.
Yeah. So the rumors have started. It's always noteworthy around here when you get the rumors. So that's my first. That's our first one. Mark it down. May 29th. The rumors of us leaving, which is always a good thing. Great. Well, thank you very much. It's always attractive to, on the single sales factor to help out folks that are doing business in Oregon, employing Oregonians, and insuring Oregonians, obviously, worldwide, but in Oregon, too.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
John Phillips, Department of Revenue. I think the Department of Insurance is here. And then if anyone else... I just called up the people that I know have been really involved, but if anyone else is involved, just wave at me. No one waved.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Phillips of the Oregon Department of Revenue. I think we're on board with that, and if your approval, we'll walk down to LC and ask for Dash 3.
Okay. If Chris could join you, that would be helpful to us because he's been clear on what our perspective committee. Yes, sir.
Eric Smith, Oregon Department of Revenue, Corporate Tax Manager.
I'm just here to answer questions.
Here to answer questions.
Any questions for the department?
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So we'll reschedule, Monday?
Monday's a holiday.
We could.
We're not here
it is an option. We could do it. And everyone will, I'll be the most unpopular Oregonian if I force people to come. We could do that. So we'll try to do it Tuesday. Tuesday we'll try to reschedule this. Thank you. Close the work session on Senate Bill 179 and look forward to a Dash 3 amendment. So if y'all could go to Legislative Council, I think you're doing it, and Chris is going to attend with you. You know what we're... Okay. Oh, you do? Okay. Let's have Paul do 2235. Well, let's do 807.
Are you fine on 2235?
I can also think I have time to do my restaurant interrogation.
Oh, okay. All right. I think I'm fine.
Okay. Open a work session on Senate Bill 2235. Paul, I believe you're going to sub in for Chris on this is the Reconnect Bill. Chris, if I could steal you before you go, I don't know how logistically to do this. I did want to ask a couple questions on the one item that I noted on the Reconnect was the new provisions for restaurants. If you could talk about, I got information from you, and I don't know if we have anyone here from the Restaurant Association. We could probably get them here pretty quick if we talk about disconnecting from this one factor. Any information that you would have, no amendments before us on this.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yeah, that provision allowed for a 15-year straight line depreciation, as opposed to under current law or prior to that law, there was the 15-year straight line depreciation allowed for restaurant leasehold improvements, and that was set to sunset on December 31st, 2005, and the comparison there, under normal circumstances, it would be 39-year depreciation. So going to 15-year, you get this cost difference. It allows more depreciation in a shorter time period. And so what that provision did was just extend the sunset date from December 31st, 2005 through December 31st, 2007. And that had a revenue impact of, I believe, about $2.5 million.
I think it was, yeah,
something like that.
And it seemed to be around the same for 9/11, or?
Yes, it was fairly flat there.
Okay, so 2 to 2.5. Obviously, I had a question on that. Did any other members of the committee have any questions or any interest in pursuing that matter at all?
Well, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Monroe.
The testimony was that, of course, by the nature of restaurant business, they remodel more frequently. They have more wear and tear on their tables and their benches and whatever else, and so on. And also, the restaurant business itself has a lot of turnover. A lot of them are sold and resold and close and reopen and under a new name and so on and so forth. So the volatility, I guess, would be the way I describe it, of their business makes a shorter depreciation timeline probably justifiable.
Great. Senator George, you have indicated you didn't not interested in. Okay, thank you, Chris. I think I'm the only one that is particularly interested in that federal tax change, which means you can go to council and join the insurance companies.
Does that mean we ought to vote the chair?
I think I'm the only, unless Senator Starr is feeling particularly interested in that federal change. I see none. I didn't see a nod there.
Okay. Mr. Chair, you didn't lobby me on it, so.
I didn't. It was just one that came up, obviously, when we were getting from the CPAs the information, and was one that just kind of stood out to me. Paul, do you want to talk to us about the CPI amendment, the Dash 1? And hopefully, members, you've got... Hi, Senator Burdick. Hopefully, you got the information from Paul about the Dash 1 amendments on the date of the CPI.
Mr. Chair, actually, you have a Dash 2 amendment.
Yeah.
Which, and there's a reason for that. That is that you look under Section 4A... There is a conflict amendment put in there that council spotted when we requested. So that's the only difference between the Dash 2 and the Dash 1 is the Section 4A that reflects the passage of another bill. The other key element of the key element of the Dash 2s is on page 4. And what that does is it aligns the dates in which we adjust the various elements of the personal income tax to changes in the price level. Back in 2001, we had noticed that there were a number of different indexes that were used. The Portland CPI was used in some places. The U.S. citywide average was used in some places. The Bureau of Labor Statistics recommends that states use the U.S. citywide average rather than these individual regional indexes, arguing that those are the sample is not as big and they're not as reliable. So we made that change in 2001, but during that same session, the legislature also first began to index the standard deduction. And so that standard deduction index is tied to the U.S. city average, contrary to what I told the chair earlier. It is tied to the U.S. city average, but it is tied at a different date. And if you look on lines 16 through 18 there on page 4, you can see what this would do is change the base would stay the same, but the index would be tied to the 12 months ending August 31 of the prior year. Currently, it's tied to the second quarter of the tax year, the current year. The reason for that change, one, is to provide consistency in terms of the different elements of the tax code that we index, so they're indexed to the same dates, and it makes sense to have them consistent. And the other thing is that the Department of Revenue and we, when we're looking ahead in terms of doing estimates, we actually know what that inflation adjustment factor will be prior to the beginning of the tax year. We would know it by August 31 of 2006, for example. You'd know what the 2007 inflation adjustment will be. So the impact of doing that, in effect, we have moved up the date to August 31 of the prior year. That does have the effect of increasing revenue on a one-time basis and then an ongoing basis a lesser amount. But you can see in 2007, 2009, we do estimate, this is based on the forecast, we have the May forecast, that it would be $8.1 million. I think the memo I had given the chair and a couple of you had $7.8 million. We've just updated this for the May forecast. So it is tied to the May revenue projection, tied to the CPI used in that forecast. So that number, of course, would bounce around depending on what happens with the inflation rate. It could actually end up being a negative if we were to have a period in which the CPI were actually to fall. Mm-hmm. But, of course, we anticipate that we'll continue to have a rising CPI, although the rates of CPI change in the forecast are 2.1 for the current year and then 1.9 for the next year. So we're in pretty low inflation territory still in terms of the forecast. So these would the bill itself, because it's a technical adjustment, because it's prospective based on anticipated inflation, council informs us that it would not be a bill for raising revenue. Again, it could lose revenue depending on what happens to the CPI. And secondly, it is lines us and puts us in sync timing-wise with the IRS. So therefore, with their inflation index, they use that same August 31 date as well that we use for our brackets, and we would use if you approve this bill. So that gives the connection to the relating clause connecting to the federal tax code.
Questions for Paul?
Anyone wish to testify? We're in work session on House Bill 2235 or the dash twos. Senator George.
Move the dash two amendments to House Bill 2235.
Senator George has moved the dash two amendments to House Bill 2235. Discussion. Any objections to that motion? So ordered. Senator George.
And then move House Bill 2235 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George has moved House Bill 2235 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Objections to that motion. So ordered. Senator George, would you like to carry the bill?
It doesn't make a difference. I can.
Senator George will carry the bill. Close the work session on House Bill 2235. Mary, do you have 807? Okay, so we'll do Senate Bill 807 next. Open a work session on Senate Bill 807, and I'll turn it over to Senator Starr.
You will, Mr. Chair.
If you'd like me to. If not, I can.
Well, what I would prefer is just to have a couple of the folks that participate in the work group come up and go through the consensus amendments. Thanks to the dash three amendments to Senate Bill 807. I believe that Legislative Council got it right from my understanding the nods that we had yesterday when folks reviewed them. So, Dan, if you want to maybe go through the amendment, Mr. Chair, if that's okay.
And Senator Starr, who this was your who else worked with you?
Well, I won't get everybody, but we had the attorney from Wilsonville, Dan Klein, Doris Penhall, Gary Oxley, Clackamas County was represented, and Steve Bryant from the League of Oregon Cities. There might have been one or two others, but that's the crux of the individuals that participated in the work group. And we came to consensus. Nobody got everything they wanted, I think, but I think everybody was generally satisfied that it improved the bill.
Thanks,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Monroe.
Has Senator Johnson seen the dash three amendments or weighed in on them at all? She has. Okay.
Thank Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dan Klem, Interim Director of Oregon Department of Aviation. Thank you for the opportunity to work on the consensus committee on this valuable bill. I did, Senator Monroe did confirm with Senator Johnson that she believes that these amendments are appropriate and will encourage the movement of the dash three. So I'm speaking for her, obviously, but I checked with her just before the meeting. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate again the opportunity to work on the consensus committee with all of the stakeholders and the agreement, the unanimous agreement at the end that this was something everybody thought was good for the bill. It does essentially eight things. Senator Deckert, you had asked for a 10-year sunset. That's in there. It for the State Aviation Board had recommended that the advisory committee would have an advisory opinion for projects outside of the fence of an airport, but or that they would have unanimous approval for projects outside the fence, but for projects inside the fence, that their opinion would be advisory. That would allow the airport sponsor to still retain control of what happens on the airport. The word all was added to include all taxing jurisdictions in the approval required to put together a tax increment financing district. That was important to a number of stakeholders. It deleted the ability to spend money for the Department of Aviation on administration, which was not the intent of the bill. The intent of the bill is infrastructure. It adds a fourth member to the public committee to include the local governments, which was an important addition. And it also requires a plan, something that folks know that the money is going to be spent on. So it requires a plan or an airport layout plan, which would detail all of the future functions and infrastructure requirements to make the airport to improve safety on the airport. It also, the dash two amendment included it, but the dash two amendments are included in this dash three amendment, and it imported the it, imported the ability to go up to a 10-mile radius from the center of the airport. That doesn't mean that everybody may buy into the 10-mile radius, but the 10-mile radius is important for many of the rural airports because an infrastructure improvement that would provide better access to the airport, such as a traffic light or maybe a water sewer improvement, which could be done off the airport. We wanted to give quite a distance there so that many of Oregon's rural airports could form a district that could make improvements off the airport. And we figured that 10 miles was probably a pretty reasonable distance. And it also adds air parks to the consideration for airport tax increment financing. And with that, those are the main things that happened, and Steve Bryant can please add to that.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Plum.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Steve Bryant with the League of Oregon Cities. I first want to express appreciation to Senator Starr for his leadership and quickly guiding the committee or the work group through these changes and helping us achieve what I told Dan earlier was 95% agreement on these changes. And I think we're pretty comfortable with the bill. I can tell you we still have some of our members, Wilsonville in particular, that has some concerns. I think you have a map in front of you that shows the 10-mile radius around the Aurora Airport. I think they're highlighting their concern about the potential magnitude. Is that in front of you? I thought I passed that earlier. Maybe it isn't in front of you.
It will be shortly.
As you'll see from that map, it actually would take in several other cities in their region if it went out that far. I think there are some built-in protections in the bill for cities. Certainly the clarification that formation of the district requires the approval of all the affected taxing district is a protection. The addition of membership from the affected city or counties is a protection. And I would note that the committee can be four or multiples of four, and it may be in an airport situation like Aurora, it would be appropriate to include representation from multiple public agencies and actually have a committee that is 8 or 12 that would provide some additional protections. And the fact that there has to be 100% agreement for expenditures inside the fence. The primary concern there, I think, for us was the inclusion of planning and maintenance activities as an eligible expenditure. Unlike traditional urban renewal that is limited to capital infrastructure, this tool does allow for ongoing maintenance activities to be used through this tax increment financing tool. And we have some sort of precedent-setting concerns about using that for maintenance. However, the protection in the bill is that it requires 100% of the committee of which local government is represented. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. I would like you to note Wilsonville's concerns about the 10-mile radius issue. I understand the department's issue with the more rural airports in more remote areas, but that's, I think, our only remaining concern.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Senator Starr.
Just to add to the testimony, I think that, as Mr. Bryant mentioned, local governments have an opt-in. I mean, there's no requirement that any local government within that 10-mile radius participate, and that, I think that was a key part of this whole process, that all the local governments have to basically be on board. That's a pretty high, hard bar to meet, and you have the example of Aurora in front of you, but I think that you've got airports all over Oregon where the 10 miles does make a lot more sense than perhaps it does for Aurora. The other piece is that there are the bill's silent really on the agreement that would be reached between local governments and any tax increment financing as it relates to an airport. And those things are negotiated at the local level between an airport operator or sponsor and the local governments through MOUs. I trust local city councilors and mayors and county commissioners to protect the public interest in their jurisdictions. And I think that those issues can be worked out at the local level, and we don't have to be super prescriptive in the state law as it relates to how these things may be implemented. When you do that, you create problems, I think, because, again, a one-size-fits-all kind of mentality and statute, I think, is harmful. So I think that's important, that this isn't overly prescriptive, and it will allow flexibility at the local level. But we did include pretty high bars as it relates to that. Another piece I think that's critically important that's part of this amendment is the requirement for a plan. Originally, there was no talk about a plan in the original bill or in the Dash 2 amendment. And I think that's critically important to me, that the sponsor goes through and identifies, okay, we're going to, you know, if we get this tax increment financing, here's the plan, here's how it's going to get spent. And that's, I think, important so that the public and, you know, the partners at the local level understand clearly what is the expectation of how these dollars are going to be spent.
And what they're giving up.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Questions for Senator Starr or for Aviation Department or the cities?
Mr. Chairman, I just add one other point with regard to the plan. I think this will happen. It's not prescriptive in the bill. If we had written this to our preference, we probably would have asked that the planning document that's communicated to the taxing jurisdictions include whether or not they intend to use this tool for maintenance and operations. The plan, as specified in the bill, only pertains to the capital improvements. What I'd like to, I guess, get on the record is the intent of the department to include in their communications with local governments whether or not they intend to use this tool for annual operating expenses, planning activities, and the other things that are not specified in the planning document.
Mr. Kleinman, do you want to come on up and bear?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mr. Bryant's referring to page 2 of the Dash 3 amendments, which would be line 22. Airport management projects, including maintenance planning, design, noise abatement, land use planning, and other essential airport operations efforts, many times those are known after you get into the infrastructure project. Noise abatement is certainly a community management relations issue. Sometimes those kinds of activities for an airport sponsor you don't know about or you can't quantify when you put together the plan. The department clearly intends on communicating any of its costs it would have to spend outside of the infrastructure plan for those types of expenses. The problem is plans are done once every 7 to 10 years. They cost quite a bit of money. We try our best to incorporate those costs in the plan, and so that's our intent in this regard that Mr. Bryant's bringing up.
Senator Deckard, members of the committee, thank you. I appreciated working in the work group as well on behalf of the counties.
The name and...
Doris Penwell with the Association of Oregon Counties. I believe the amendments, just to clarify something about what's included in the plan, I believe the amendments on page 3, line 22, say that the Public-Private Partnership Committee shall make recommendations for all of the expenditures included in 1B of this section. And 1B of the section does, in the original bill, on page 2 of the amendments, includes both the airport-related infrastructure projects as well as the airport management projects, including maintenance. So even though you may not know the total cost of those airport maintenance projects, maintenance, et cetera, it would be a line item clearly in the plan. So I think it does lend itself to including everything that you might include in the plan. And the department, when they're writing their rules, would take that into consideration in putting together how the thing should operate, I would suspect.
Great. Other questions for... Thank you. Wilsonville, would you like to get on the record on this issue before we...
Mr. Chair, I just put for the record as well, say that the attorney for Wilsonville was in the room and nodded his head when these amendments were in this whole discussion. So
Thank you, Chairman Deckert, members of the committee. The city of Wilsonville, like to go on record opposing this bill. We just think it's premature. This is the kind of issue that we should take an interim committee, take a look at. There are lots of unintended consequences, and there's lots of stakeholders who have not been heard from. So we would urge you not to pass it forward today, but rather to give us some time during the interim to work on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for City of Wilsonville?
Thank you very much.
Okay.
I'll tell Charlotte you did a good job.
Thank you.
Okay, we're in work session.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move the -3 amendments to Senate Bill 807.
Senator Starr moved the -3 amendments to Senate Bill 807. Discussion. Objections to that motion. Senator Starr.
Mr. Chair, I move the bill as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr's move, Senate Bill 807 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr and then Senator Monroe. Senator
My only comment is to thank Harrison Conley for his work on the amendment. Mm-hmm. He's got a pile of work to do, and, mm-hmm. and it came out well, and just wanted to put that on the record.
I'm glad you did. And rapid.
Yeah.
He turned it around in 2 or 3 days and headed out to us so that we could look at it. I'm glad you said that. Senator Monroe.
And Mr. Chair, I just wanted to thank Senator Starr for his good work and quick work at bringing almost everybody together on this bill.
Well, I'm not glad you said that. His head's getting too big these days. He might file a minority report on this bill if we don't watch it.
We can't do that.
That's true. That's true. Thank you, Senator Starr, for turning something around in 4 or 5 days and having a near-consensus bill, understanding Wilsonville's objection, but also understanding that they were a part of and at least included in the deliberations on the -3. Kind of a roll of dice.
that frustrates me to see that, really, honestly, because the attorney was in the room, I can remember his name, from Wilsonville, had significant input about what was put into this bill from the, you know, the city perspective. You know, we kind of went around the room, and you know, from my perspective, there was consensus. And so it frustrates me that now Wilsonville's here through their lobbyists saying, "Well, we need more time, blah blah blah." But that being what it is, you know, I understand.
It's a good point that your currency oftentimes in this building is how you participate in work groups, and it is a currency that is a part of what we do. Senator Starr, have you moved the bill as amended?
Yes.
Further discussion? Any objections to that motion? So ordered. Senator Starr, would you carry the bill? Senator Starr will carry the bill, and we'll close.
Wait, Chair, I don't believe the bill was moved. I think it was just the amendment.
No,
I moved
he
the
did
bill.
Move the bill.
We did the amendment.
Okay.
I believe we.
Yes.
Yes.
We got half say yes, half say no. Can we move it twice? Should we move it twice just in case? Okay, Senator Starr.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 807 as amended to Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 807, I believe for the second time too, as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
I just think it's good that we speak firmly.
That's true. Maybe we'll do that. We'll make that something we do every time here. We'll move bills twice out of our committee. Every bill, just so we're firm and... That's right. We'll run up the score. We get to do it so infrequently. Further discussion? So ordered. Senator Starr, would you carry the bill?
Certainly.
It's like Groundhog Day. Close the work session on Senate Bill 807. Last bill. Open a work session on Senate Bill 550. And while Steve makes his way up here, I will, since I asked for the amendment to be drafted to 550, the amendment, and Steve can provide better explanation and certainly answer any questions, but the amendment is intended to do simply one thing, and that is the small high school money that is outside the formula, so not the grant within the formula, but the money that comes out on top of the formula, puts a 5-year sunset so that... That $2.5 million a year in 5 years would be reviewed by this body, and we would make a decision whether to go forward with that or to alter it. Steve?
Mr. Chair, that's an accurate description. The sunset would take effect on June 30th, 2012, 5 years basically from now, and delete the language that distributes this money to the small school districts that have small high schools, the $2.5 million. That money comes out of the state school fund. It goes into the small school district supplement fund and then to the districts, the small districts with the small high schools. So basically, the bill would take away that $2.5 million from the districts with the small high schools and distribute it to all districts through the formula.
So they would get a portion of, if it wasn't renewed, they'd get a portion, but not the $2.5 million off the top.
Correct. The $2.5 million going to all districts would be about $3.65 per weighted student. The loss to the small school districts with the small high schools would be about $29 per weighted student, but then that would be partially offset by that gain, so it would be about $25 in debt.
Great. Questions for Steve or for me?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I just think this is a prudent thing to do. Not all small high schools are poor. I can think of one in Southwest Portland in particular that's very wealthy. And it's appropriate that we review this policy. We might want to adjust, for example, the definition of a small school. Maybe it's appropriate, maybe it's not. This gives, 4 years for the legislature and the Department of Education and others to weigh in, to justify a continuation, if in fact it is justified, or to recommend modification, if that's appropriate, or to allow the repeal to take place, if that's appropriate. So I just think this is a very prudent action. I thank the chair for bringing this to us.
Thank you, Senator Monroe. Other discussion? Herbert.
I agree. I think we need to take a hard look at this program to make sure it's accomplishing what we need to accomplish, and this will help.
Thank you. Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, in my previous district, I had a school district, very small school, school district, high school, very high cost. At first, I was skeptical about their cost. Then I looked at their operations and came to the conclusion they really did have that. But there's nothing that stops us from having a good, fair look, as Senator Monroe said, about, you know, who is deserving and who is not. So I'm going to be fine with it.
Thank you, Senator.
I think it's unanimous, Mr. Chair.
I do think the state's going to have, and hopefully this is just a small helpful step, a discussion about, I think it's coming, about the formula as a whole, how growth at districts and non-growth and declining enrollment in small high schools and all fit in, and maybe this is very minor in that, but hopefully a little bit helpful. And seeing Mr. Marshall behind you, Chuck, you and I both can get out of that conversation because that's always a really difficult one, and I think Mr. Marshall's probably glad he might get to miss that one. Okay. Anyone who would like to make a motion?
No, you're the vice chair.
All right. We were never going to agree, so move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 550.
Well, we'll let Senator Monroe do the, since we're moving everything twice, so we'll have you move.
Oh, okay.
Senator Monroe. Senator George has moved the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 550. Discussion. Objections.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Monroe.
I move Senate Bill 550 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Monroe has moved Senate Bill 550 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Objections to that motion. So ordered. I will carry that bill unless someone would like to. I will carry it, and we are adjourned. We are adjourned for a while, Paul, because Monday's Memorial Day. So I guess we'll put it to a vote of the committee. We could come back and work on 179 on Memorial Day.
We're not meeting tomorrow?
We do not have a meeting scheduled for tomorrow.
Okay. See you next Tuesday.
Okay. Have a great Memorial Day. We are adjourned.
It's longer for a week.